Hi, I'm John.
And I'm Kevin.
Two creatives who place creativity at the center of our lives. And this is the Time is Right podcast. Okay, we are back with another in our interview series. Today we have Toronto-based singer-songwriter Danny Horowitz, possibly the voice of his generation. Danny, welcome.
Thank you. Possibly. I mean, possibly. Possibly.
But you can't go wrong. Nobody can deny that.
No, you can deny. That's right.
Many people have said I could be thank you so much for having me on. The time is right to be here, so thank you.
Oh, thank you. Nice. Glad to have you. Okay. So, we mentioned singer-songwriter, but I'm sure there's more to you than that. So, let's just drive right in. Kevin, you want to start?
Oh, you're going to make me go with the first questions.
Yeah.
If you guys don't have questions, I'll ask you questions.
No, I do, actually. And actually, we kind of usually start by just asking, what are you currently working on right now? What's your creative endeavor?
I mean, there's I guess, two, but now three things. The main one is releasing music. I've set myself up with a long pipeline of music, and I put out a single earlier called Sorry from the Road that right now people are listening to. I'm really excited about it. And a new song coming out on June 2nd called It's No Use Trying to Change Me. And I've got a new song coming out every 6 weeks till November, kind of building an album in a waterfall strategy. So that's the first one, the release part of it. The second one is the music that I've been recording now, early on in this year. I'm working on the vocals for the tracks that will form an album that I'll be releasing starting next year. So that's really creatively fulfilling for me. And the third thing that I just found out from my producer, he's a producer, engineer, just wunderkind. And he works or volunteers or has some association with a school for audio engineers. And he's invited me to come in and work with some of his students. So I'm going to have access to a studio with three different student engineers. So I'm going to take songs that I don't know either would have been good enough or maybe just appropriate for an album and really workshop them to find out a comfortable place for me to perform them and see if I can go in with limited amount of time, limited amount of takes, almost like a rough cut demo type with these students, and the results could be something that's like bad but interesting, or something that is actually really good. And maybe I'm thinking, if they're all three good, maybe release them down the road as like a studio session workshop from the cutting room floor kind of EP. But a lot of creativity, and that's the stuff that I like more than the promotion stuff. So I'm excited. I have all these songs. You know, when you pick for the album, you leave all these ones out that don't make it for various reasons. I said good enough, but what I mean is just maybe not right in the right mix. And so that's kind of cool. That's what I'm working on.
That's a lot.
It is a lot. What I like about that, though, especially for us with kind of taking it from the creative aspect, is the fact that you're working with others who are also really just getting their start in whatever it is that they're working on, you know, new sound engineers, people just kind of getting their feet into the business, and you're learning and growing together. I really like.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I agree. I love the collaborative nature of music. I think that's the best. I write these songs and my name is on the songs when they come out, but ultimately it's a collaborative effort, and I make that as clear as I possibly can. And I work with these amazing professionals, probably some of the best indie artists in Toronto, if not Canada, technicians and musicians. And so the fact that I'm still relatively new to all this, when my producer says that there's an opportunity to work with people in his technical side who are new, I'll jump at the chance. I love it. I just love engaging. You know, it's so much fun and so joyous.
Nice. So you've kind of answered this a little bit already, but I think I'm going to ask it anyway. Everybody has some kind of creative fuel, some kind of motivation, something that really gets them going. And you've mentioned the collaboration, and obviously you've been getting some really interesting opportunities lately. Put a pin in that for a second, but something energizes you to write songs in the first place. What motivates you?
That's a really good question. I read a lot. And when anyone asks me, how do I write songs? The first answer I give them is read, you know? The other answer I should probably add is live. The more that you live, the more that you experience, the more that you feel, the more you're in a position to write. It's not like So most of writing is setting down, putting the practice of practice, the discipline of discipline. You go to your guitar, you go to your piano, you hit, I personally hit chords, figure out fiddling different around with different combinations until I feel something, try to put words to those things. But once I have a feeling, well, good songwriting is describing those feelings, and in my case, describing them usually through a story of some kind. Mm-hmm. And for that, I need to have read a lot of other people's experiences, fictional or non-fictional, or have experienced a lot through my own, not because I'm telling my own story, but because I'm using the feelings that I can remember from those experiences into the songs that I'm writing. John Mayer was giving this talk that I saw on YouTube, and he was talking to musical students about how important it is to go to class and get the technical elements down. But what's even more important if you want to be a songwriter is go out there in a walk in the rain and think about your life and think about how you're doing and get that inspiration. So it really is about living and reading in order to have the foundation so that when you go to play and write songs, you come with all of that in your back pocket. But I will add, and I really want to emphasize this, it doesn't happen out of the blue. You have to set aside time to play music. You got to love playing music. You got to love it. And you show up, and sometimes you start off playing other people's songs. You've written a couple of songs. You practice your songs. And then you just fiddle around. You noodle around. And then it hits you. And then all that work you've done of living kind of comes to you. So what inspires me to write song? I love to play. I love to think. I love to read. And I just love doing it.
And John, he's a guitarist, and he said noodle.
Well, how do you describe it?
No, that's exactly how we described it.
So Kevin and I were in the same band that I was mentioning before we started the recording. He was a bass player in the first incarnation of the band, and the one that actually got to go to a studio and record 24 tracks to 2-inch tape. Those were the days.
Yeah. But it was digital.
It ended up on digital, but yes. It was like a Betamax.
I mean, I'm grateful that those days are gone because I would not know how to do that.
I don't miss it.
I wouldn't make home demos. But noodling around is a Paul McCartneyism because I heard him use that expression years ago. I'm a monster Beatles fan, me and everyone else in the world, right? And I heard him use that expression. Thought, oh, that's great. I get so much from the Beatles even to this day. I've written songs just because the Beatles have read or said things. And I thought, oh, that would make a great title for a song. And then I sit down and write the song.
There you go.
That sometimes inspiration comes from the strangest things.
So let's cast your mind back, way back, or maybe not so way back. Do you remember when you first deliberately tried a creative project? In other words, not just playing around as a little kid, but you said, you know what, I'm going to make this thing, you know, with intention, whether it was musical or anything, really.
I actually do remember that. It's not musical. When I was in the second grade, I'd moved from Quebec, and I'd moved to a small town outside of Ontario. And it happened to be Canada's birthday coming up. It was a milestone, maybe 125th anniversary, or something like that. And I was a really outgoing kid, but the teacher, Mrs. Metcalf, gave me a line in the school was doing an assembly, and every class does a presentation, and I got a line, and I can't remember what the line was, but I remember really, really milking that line, making it for all it's worth, making hay of it, and the teacher really liked that. It was my own kind of spin on whatever the line was. That's the first time that I must have been seven, or this is before I picked up any instruments, before I joined the school choir. It was my first kind of time really presenting to an audience, and I remember it so distinctly because when push came to shove, we did a couple of performances. The first performance, I had absolute stage fright, and the teacher had to pull me aside and say, you did it so well in rehearsal, what happened, and have a whole talk about that, and I had to think about what stage fright was and work through that. But that was the first time that I ever did anything creative because I took these lines and I kind of performed them.
Yeah.
Can't believe I remembered that.
That's great. Well, it's obviously imprinted upon you. And it sounds like it wasn't just berating you for having stage fright. It was encouraging you to kind of grow out of that and do a little better or whatever.
Absolutely. And I've been lucky when I was a kid to have really good teachers that make all the difference. And in that case, the talk really centered around getting over the fears and what it feels like. And the funny thing about stage fright is, I guess in a way, I still have it. We all do. The difference is when you think about how stage fright feels, those feelings of nervousness. Well, the feeling of nervousness is also the same feeling you get when you're excited. So it's actually just about changing your perspective. There's no time you don't go on stage and you don't feel a rush. It's what you do with that rush. Mm-hmm. It's how you interpret it.
Yep. Or convert that fearful energy, that flight energy into, in some ways, fight energy.
So, I don't want to fight with the audience, but I know.
No,
what you mean.
but you know, in some ways, you're fighting with yourself, not to run, not to go screaming into the void, which is what I wanted to do with our first gig.
I've got a few different questions, but I'll stick with this thread. Was there ever a time when you weren't creating? And if so, what was that like? You know, after you've kind of established a creative practice, then was there a time where you had to stop for some reason? And what did that feel like?
I mean, I guess there's two answers. One is that the philosophical, we always live in the moment. And so whatever that moment requires, we are living in it. And sometimes we're creative and sometimes we're not. But I'll give you the more practical answer, which is that yes. And I came to record music a little later in life than I might have. I'm in my 30s. And that's because of really fear. Mm. You know, I'm a pretty outgoing person. I think that's how most of my friends would describe me. But the one thing that I always really wanted to do, which was take the songs that I'd written and perform them, I was too shy, too scared. Mm. So I'd only do it at open mic nights or in hiding. And I'd play a lot in my bedroom. And I was self-conscious of my singing voice, of my playing abilities. And so I would still write music. But eventually the music gets stale because there's no feedback. There's no one telling you it's good. You're not having someone listen to you say, hey, you sound like this. And then you listen to that. And it's like, oh, that's a little bit different. Here's how it's different. And there's just less of a cycle. And it becomes demotivating in a way when, I mean, it's great to write music for yourself. And that's the reason you should do it. But you also do realize how important it is to have the world around you acknowledge that side of you. Just suddenly, I don't know, opens things up that it's hard to explain. And so for many years, I really did separate out the time when I was creative and the time when I was everything else. And now they bleed a little bit more into each other in like the most beautiful kind of way.
It is motivating. I went for quite a while without really sharing much or putting stuff on YouTube and then not actually telling anyone. But then, you know, as I've shared a little wider and got a little more confidence, started putting stuff on Spotify, getting more listens, and I start getting that feedback. And, you know, it's like, it is incredibly motivating, I think, to even bad feedback. It's like, somebody listened to it.
Somebody listened to it. That's like 90% of the winning. Well, I'll give you another really interesting example that's come up now, because I'm not the best technical musician. I write these songs and I do what I can and I enjoy playing it, but I've always been very self-conscious of my playing, and I've hesitated to put videos of myself performing on YouTube. When you hear my studio sounds, like I said, it's a lot of my collaborators, although I am more and more getting a bit of myself on those albums. And on the records. But now I've recently put up some videos of me performing at shows on YouTube, just as like a sample. And the response has been either great or non-existent. So nobody actually really is a hater. They either are a supporter or they've got other things in their lives going on. And there's a certain amount of freedom. Like, if someone were to really hate on me, actually, I would take it as a compliment because it means that I got under their skin.
What's the line there from the pirate movie? Jack Sparrow says, "Ah, but you have heard of me." When they call him the worst pirate ever. Yeah. Well, kind of along those same lines, I was listening to some of your music, and what struck me is that a lot of your lyrics, I mean, almost all of them are very personal. Obviously, first person, it doesn't seem like you're putting on a persona that it is you. And there's a lot of vulnerability in your words. I guess I'm wondering, do you ever feel like you're saying something in a song that you couldn't say out loud to another person? I mean, I do this with poetry quite often.
I don't feel that way, and I'll let you in on the truth, and I'm not making any hiding of this, is that these songs aren't personal, at least not in the way that you might mean them. They come from a place of emotional truth. I try to write those emotional truths, feeling what I'm feeling, describing them, drawing on my memories, drawing on what I've read, how I felt, what that meant to me. But the stories aren't actually about my life, so I don't have any reservations whatsoever about expressing the stories. And the self-consciousness I had was less about telling the stories live than it was about how people will think about me, the way that I stand and the way that I sing and the way that I play and all of that stuff that you can get trapped in. I love writing stories. I want to share those stories. Sometimes I listen back and I hear myself in them, my stories in them, but that's me as a listener, as the author of the meaning post-production, very different than me as the writer who's like, what can I, how do I further this story? What are these characters? Who are these people? And I write in the first person in partially because it's lazy, right? It's just easier to, partially because it's always the way I've done it. When I heard music as a kid, I never thought that that's what, that the singer was the person they were talking about. Years later, to find out that this is actually something that happened to them kind of blew my mind away. I thought they were just writing novels. You know, novels are written in the first person too. I don't think of them as the author. And so that's the perspective I bring.
That, I find that actually kind of interesting because with readers, I think the opposite seems to be more more common, where they assume that the author is the person speaking, and it's often very difficult for readers to separate that. So it was interesting. So I think your music has that feel as if it was biographical, autobiographical.
And I do try to, you know, make it into songs and stories that people can relate to, you know, and I've learned along the way in songwriting that the more specific the story, the more weirdly, ironically universal the appeal, the more relatable it is. So I did literature in undergrad, and I mentioned how much I love reading, and that's all kinds of things, but in particular fiction. And one of the things that we learned in the theory course, and you guys probably know all about this because you're writers yourselves, is that the reader of the work is in many ways the author of its meaning, not the writer of the work.
Yes.
You give it over. And there's a beautiful, liberating feeling as a writer in knowing that. So it's like, if you think that that's about me and now you have a problem with me, that's not a me problem. That's a you problem.
Right.
That's, and you can take out of that what you want, and you can take the meaning, you can gather all the meaning you need from it to do whatever you want to do with it. And that's kind of great. But it's not the perspective that I take, even though I want to acknowledge that I am, when I write songs, I'm writing songs to make stories interesting to me. And the specificity is how you get that relatability. Because when I write it, I want to be able to relate to it too, you know?
Right.
I've been reading kind of interviews with Nick Cave. The book is Faith, Hope, and Carnage. And it's a fairly recent, it was interviews conducted over around 2021. So it's quite recent. But there was something that struck me. Cave is someone who writes songs very much from his own personal viewpoint, as opposed to telling stories that resonated with him. It's usually in some way related to his experience. But he said something really interesting in one of these interviews that sometimes he finds songs to be in some way prescient, that he doesn't know what they mean when he's writing them, and somehow become more relatable to him when they're done and he's heard them. And I find that a fascinating take on songwriting. It's just like the song comes out of him and he's writing it, and then in some ways it's like, oh, that's what that meant.
I do agree with that too. Sometimes it takes me a while to listen back and change and think about it and what it means to me personally. There is a bit of, I think it was E.M. Forster who said, how do I know what I think until I've said it? And that E.M. Forster was probably quoting some Greek philosopher at that point. But that is like a very ancient thing. I cite the Greeks because the Greeks talked about the muses. How does Homer begin all of his epics? It's, oh, muse, breathe through me. We don't know where that inspiration comes from. It's just breathed into us. And so I agree with that. And I'm not trying to be dishonest about my life experiences. I have written songs that are personal. Some of them do make it onto my albums. Some of them are good. I find that when I write a song with the intention of keeping it confined to what I want it, to my life, it's either not very good or it's too personal. And then I don't like playing it after it's done. So I allow the breathing room to change it into something completely different. And then the results are more flexible. I think more interesting. There's no baggage to me. It's just, it becomes a thing I continue to enjoy playing.
Right. Yeah, and I don't think there's anything dishonest or untruthful or inauthentic writing about other people's stories or writing about things that, you know, are inspired by not your own life, because it's still coming through you. It's still coming through the lens of your experience and your emotional space. So in that essence, I think the authenticity is absolutely always present, regardless of what the source of the inspiration is.
I think in all storytelling, the truth of what's in it is not the truth of the content, but the truth of where it comes from and what it means.
Mm-hmm. The emotional truth, absolutely. Yep. You know, what's great about art, whether it's painting or poetry or novels or music, is you can't help but take your influences and have them filter through you into something that's quintessentially you.
Yes.
And that's why a lot of the discussions around ownership are almost meaningless. Everything you create is you. I mean, there's plagiarism, but for the most part, take what you can, filter it through you, and it will be something new. I don't know if you were following the Ed Sheeran.
I was just thinking about that.
I was thinking to myself, like, I'm glad that they found for him. I personally didn't hear the song "Let's Get It On" in his. But even if it was, even if he cited it as one of his inspirations, even if he cited it as the main inspiration for that song, that's a far cry. They're two very different songs. It sounds so different. I just don't understand why the legal precedent would do that, because you're stifling creativity if you allow something like that to happen, which is, again, different from plagiarism, different from direct stealing. But that was kind of top of mind for me during the last couple of weeks, because I don't even really know where all of my influences come, and who knows who I've given credit to and why I said this song was important to me. Maybe some song was important to me that wasn't on my mind when I wrote this song, and it came through, and now you hear it and you sue me. Why should I have to think about that as a creative? It's so hard as it is to make a living, and it's so hard as it is to just create. We should be encouraging creativity, not discouraging. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I recently finished a short story that I borrowed the form from a couple of different writers that I've seen use it. But my story is my story. It's the shape of it and the way it comes out that's not original, because it's just a form that's used in other forms of storytelling.
That's kind of the where things fell with the Ed Sheeran case, where they were basically trying to sue over a chord progression.
A chord progression? Are you kidding me? There's only so many chord progressions.
I was going to say, that's a pretty limited set.
So in his defense, apparently he brought out a whole bunch of well-known famous songs from decades across using the exact same chord progression, and just like, well, you know.
You could have saved a lot of time if you just played that YouTube video from Australia where they go through every song ever written in the same.
Yes, I love that.
There's this great story where Dave Grohl talks about the disco drumming he did on early Nirvana records, and he finds these musicians that inspired him, that he loved, invites him to his house, and he flat out says, "Hey, I stole this from you." He doesn't actually mean he legally stole it from them and owes them any money. He's trying to be kind and give them credit and say they inspired him. You shouldn't be held liable for that sort of thing. Again, different from plagiarism, which is a very different thing. Anyway, so you got to let yourself be inspired. Not to derail the conversation, but inspiration is important. Room for creativity is important, and people should not be discouraged from writing their own music.
Absolutely. All right. Moving on. Let's pick something else. I think I went last. Do you have one queued up, Kevin?
Sure. So you've talked a little bit about early experiences performing. How has your creativity changed over the years? You mentioned some of your self-consciousness over your guitar playing. Were you playing guitar first? Were you singing first? Did you do both? What was the progression?
Well, I was singing first. I joined the school choir when I was in the fourth grade. This is also a really interesting memory. They used to give stickers out in the school assembly for participation in things. And they were calling up the school choir. There's a whole bunch of people. And I kind of nudged my friends and I said, "Watch this." And I went up with them to get a sticker that I didn't earn. And the choir director, a beautiful soul by the name of Mrs. Claxton, sort of gave me a look and then gave me the sticker, I think not to embarrass me. And I felt bad after that. So I went up to her like next time at lunch hour and I wanted to give her the sticker back. And she said something like, "Well, why don't you just join the choir and earn the sticker? We need more boys in the choir." So that was what sort of started me singing. And then I learned a valuable lesson about where all the pretty girls go all the girls go recess. A lot of them are in the choir. Not that I did anything about it, mind you, because in my heart I was a great coward, and I guess we all are. But sorry, what was the question? Something about How did it grow?
How did it progress?
So creativity and like all the growth you do, it takes time, it takes effort, and it builds up like a coastal shelf until eventually you're at the beach. It's a beach. It's no longer underwater. Right? It's just very slowly. And that happens. You play more, you keep writing, you keep growing. I do find that similar to, let's say, working out or exercise, if you stay isolated, you end up stagnating. And so for years, a lot of my songs would probably sound the same, and I wasn't very happy with how they turned out because I'm playing on the same guitar, I'm listening to the same music. By just expressing that, hey guys, ever the world, this is what I'm doing, you get more exposure to people, like I said, and that inspires you. By working with other musicians, opens the floodgates. Like I'm more prolific and creative than I've been in years because of how much I'm exposing myself to. And I would say that I'm also, in the last couple of years, picked up a little bit more instruments. So I've got an electric guitar and even the ukulele behind me and a piano and different things. As I'm hearing like other instruments in songs, having been in the studio, it makes me think, well, what kind of song can I write that would have that sound in it when we get to the studio? This is how Sean, the musician who I'm always talking about, that's amazing. This is kind of how he recommends that we arrange the songs and what we think we should do with it in studio. What if I wrote songs with that kind of advice in mind? Calvin, my producer, likes certain kinds of songs, certain kind of lyrics. So little challenges for myself add also to that creativity. Mm-hmm. Every time you add a new tool, even if it's not a good tool, you just sort of stick it in your tool belt, you help yourself grow. Everything that you use that's new re-stimulates it. And right now I'm lucky to be in a period where I'm getting all kinds of stimulation for my creativity and songwriting, as opposed to all those years where I just sat in my bedroom playing guitar, which was fun, but as I mentioned, wasn't really being what you might call creative. I guess creativity requires others. It's like our lives. It's all about resonance. You know, you sing, the resonance in your chest, you play guitar, resonance in your instrument. We live, we exist, we get inspired by bouncing our ideas, ourselves, off other people.
Yeah, I think that's a key point, right, is you can sit there in the room and play guitar, piano, whatever, and really what you're doing is you're practicing. You're not expanding, really, in any way, unless you have some outside influence, some other thing that's pushing you in some direction, even if it's just a book, but...
Yeah, and on that note, even practicing. So when I'm practicing for a show, it's very different than when I'm just playing for myself. I'm actually thinking about the notes and hitting the wrong notes and thinking like, okay, you know what? A lot of the complicated stuff that like Eric Clapton can do, I can't do. But what can I do in my wheelhouse that will give little Easter eggs to the audience when I play with them? You know, maybe slowly, eventually I'll get better and better at playing the guitar, but I'm not. I know how to play the guitar. I'm not terrible. So let me practice with that intention in mind. I'm going to the studio with the students next week. I want to do it in as few takes as possible. So I'm practicing. And if there's a note I want to hit, I'm going to practice until I hit that note. Or if I realize I can't do it, I'm going to move on and find some other way to do it. But that's more creative, even as we think about practice, than just sitting in my room and practicing. That's just me remembering the lyrics and the chords.
Yep.
It's a great question. You guys are good at questions.
We try.
Do I get to ask the bad guy question? I can ask the bad guy question.
Sure.
I don't know where we are in the list, but sure.
Oh, we're all over the place. We're all over the place. But this, I'm loving this. This is fantastic. Okay, let's talk about failure. Everybody experiences creative failure from time to time. Have you experienced something that you felt was a creative failure? And if so, how has that helped on your journey?
Wouldn't you hate it if I gave you that answer like, nothing's a failure because it's all a learning experience? I mean, I guess
on some level. It would not be the first time.
on some level, everything's a learning experience, and so there's no failure in some level. But yes, of course. Of course I felt like a failure. The number of songs that I've written that then are like aren't very good, and I know they're not very good. The number of times I couldn't even finish a song. The number of times I practiced so hard to like go to an open mic night or go to a show, and then nobody's there. Nobody's paying attention. That feels like a failure that I couldn't capture their attention. The only thing I'll say that I've never felt like a failure at all is in the studio. There's a magic to the studio. And as long as you go with the attitude that you're there with people to create something, you will create something. Mm-hmm. And you'll be happy because you did the thing. And that thing is so, so fulfilling. But yes, of course, on a personal level, even just the fact that I started later, I in some ways, I feel like a failure. You do have to get over that. And the thing about failures is it's a learning experience. But yeah, of course, who doesn't experience failure? If you don't experience failure, then you're doing it wrong. You're kidding yourself. And one day when you do find failure, it is going to hit you so hard that you might have a nervous breakdown. So
yeah,
failures happen.
I would say if you're not experiencing failure, you're not trying hard enough.
That's so great. That's a great way to put that.
So you've mentioned a few people, the Beatles and some others. Which creators, and they don't have to be musicians, they could be anybody from any walk of life, but which creative people have inspired you throughout your life?
I mean, a lot of them are songwriters. You know, the Beatles, Paul Simon, Leonard Cohen, Billy Joel, the Eagles, the Beach Boys, all those great pop rock and rollers that you know, they're great singer-songwriters. If you love them, like I'm making off this list, the other names that pop in your head, they mean a lot to me too. So for sure, songwriters. I mentioned that I read a lot, so I don't want to be like a cliche, but I love the works of Shakespeare. I don't have them memorized like some people, but I do go back to them, and I sometimes bring them into my songwriting. When I'm in a rut, I might open Shakespeare or another poet and just have it trigger something in me that gets the ball rolling. Sometimes I just go to the Art Gallery of Ontario here in Toronto, and I just kind of walk around and I look at the paintings, and I can't always tell you the name, although we have some famous painters in Canada called the Group of Seven. Sometimes I walk through cities and I look at the architecture, the way that the cities are designed. I don't know who designed those things, but they're really cool. When I was a kid growing up, my dad played guitar and he wrote his own songs. And he put me and my three brothers at the foot of his bed while he played for us. And it's a small thing, but he was being creative and showing us how to be creative without us even really realizing it until so many years later. That's a whole lot of creativity. My mom took us to musicals when we were a kid, and I loved musicals. Like I said, I was in the school choir. We did musicals. I don't know the names of the people who were on Broadway, but the idea of singing and dancing in line and working together as a team, there's a lot of creativity in that. So some of them are names, and because of my stylistics, they're all the biggest names that you can think of, and a lot of them are the complete unknown people. So I would love to have sat here and surprised you with a name that you don't know but should know, and I can't off the top of my head think of that, and I'll kick myself later, but there's a lot of creativity that out in the world to see and get inspired by, and a lot of people, and I try to give credit where it's due, which is why when I always quote somebody, I say to quote this person, so you don't make it think that I'm super clever.
It's interesting you mentioned Paul Simon, because that when I was listening to your stuff, I was like, there's a real Paul Simon vibe there.
And I'll tell you something about Paul Simon is really inspiring, okay? So a guy like Paul McCartney, for example, has a great voice. He doesn't get enough credit on a great voice. Mm-hmm. You know, Robert Plant has like an outrageous control. Mm-hmm. There are guys who can sing really well with really sweet voices, and they're nice. Then there's like a Bob Dylan or a Leonard Cohen, who you wouldn't call nice, but they're so distinctive that they're their own thing.
They're all soul. Their own soul is good.
Yeah. But a guy like Paul Simon sings like a normal person with great stories, and he was so successful. He doesn't have a bad voice, mind you. He always hits the notes. He's a good singer. But you don't think of him as being a good singer, and it's inspiring because of how successful he is. And I'll give you one more. Maybe this is just me, and maybe I'm wrong about this. But, you know, David Bowie, I never thought had a wild voice. Mm-hmm. I just thought he had such an interesting take on everything, and his production was great. Sometimes I think Lou Reed is a good singer, and sometimes I think he's not a good singer. There's all these. But the idea really, not that I want to overly analyze it, but sometimes you have these songwriters who like have great, Cat Stevens has a great voice for sure. But otherwise, a lot of times people have voices and you're like, they're just singing like regular people, and yet they're good at it. And so Paul Simon, not just for his storytelling, not just for his writing, but also for the fact that he was able to go up there as like, you know, a little Jewish guy from some urban center, much like myself, to write and music that really touches people, that is something that I look to. And so he is one of my major influences.
Yeah. Interesting. And interesting that you mentioned Robert Plant too, because I don't know how many people realize what he's been doing with Alison Krauss.
Alison Krauss.
Yeah. I love that stuff. Yeah.
Also, he was in a band in the 70s, but the name escapes me.
Yeah, I can't. I don't know. There's a lot of screaming and yelling going on back then.
Yeah. Lemon juice or something. I don't really get it. Oh man,
that would be a great name for a band, Lemon Juice.
Yeah.
People be like, what is this?
Well, it's like some stupid TikTok I saw about how to make orange juice, and they picked up a lemon and squeezed it. I'm like, what the hell?
Do you remember on The Simpsons, there was the episode where Troy McClure is advertising like oranges, like and he's squeezing an orange into his eye and says, until now, this was the only way to make orange juice. And Homer is watching, squeezing an orange into his eye going, you mean there's a better way?
All right. Yeah. This is the lemon juice episode. I must see if I could put that in the title.
So talk about songwriting and music and all things citrus. All right. So.
All right. So we've gone through actually all our normal questions. No. Okay.
No, I still got. Oh, wait. You had some abnormal questions, if I recall.
Well, I've already asked one, but I have one other one, I think.
Shoot. Throw it out there.
So we talked about sharing and the importance of sharing, which is something that we talk about a lot. Who do you share your songs with first?
It used to be nobody. Then as I started doing demos, it was a couple of close friends of mine who I trusted. And I trust these friends. Mm-hmm. I don't share my music with them anymore because I realize they don't know anything. And I don't mean that in a bad way. They're just like, it's not useful. They want me to be the best version of myself. And any, you know, they either really like it or they give me comments that have no place being considered. Mm-hmm. Okay. So really the people that I trust, or the person I trust most is Calvin. I will also sometimes share demos with Kara McKinley. She is an audio engineer as well. She helps me with the harmonies. So the reason why the harmonies have gotten better as my music has moved forward is because on the first album, she wasn't around and I had to come up with those myself. And she's someone with a good ear for melody. So if I play a song and she really likes it, then I know, okay, make a note of there. I use myself as the judge because I don't want to hold other people accountable, right? I want to say, I made this decision. You're not responsible for any failures or anything like that. But I always trust Calvin's ear and I always give him a whole bunch of things to listen to when we come up with a selection, because just because I think something makes the top 10 for an album, he might have other ideas about what's good or what's better in the mix. He's given me comments a couple of times that songs I really like weren't actually necessarily fleshed out and they could be better. And in the meantime, there's this other song that he heard that I wrote as a throwaway song that actually he really liked. So yeah. I would say they're ones that I send early on. But once the songs have been chosen, of course, Cola, who's my normal drummer, and Sean is my normal musician, I want their thoughts for how to make them the best versions of themselves as I can. I don't do the thing where I put my music up on like the internet for the masses to criticize that, you know, that way be dragons kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. Like at the end of the day, I want to write songs that I like and I don't want to overthink it. These are people I trust and I trust them to give me a big picture view, a gut instinct, but I don't know if this is like a thing. Maybe someone told me that there's a book called The War of Art that I'm supposed to read. And the idea is do the work in quiet and silence and let them see the end results. There is some wisdom in that, mm-hmm. especially in an era where everything is given to everybody for free. I don't necessarily want them to see how the sausage is made. I don't want them to see some of it. I want them to show me practicing and so on. But I want to come with songs that they can hear and be like, wow, this is great. They don't need to know how much work went into it. They just need to know that it's something that they enjoyed. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you mentioned instinct there, and that's something that I was just recently talking about with someone. And I'm starting to kind of really learn to trust my instinct around storytelling and so forth. And I'm actually doing less planning of a story and more just writing it because I don't feel like I'm going to fail at creating the story because I've done it enough times that I can just sit down and write it and then I'll revise it and I know what a story should feel like. And I am the only one who knows how that particular story is supposed to feel. Right, and, you know, I can share it with a few people, John's one, and then I get some feedback. But again, like you said, it's people that you trust and it's people who can offer something in the realm of constructive help. You know, for John, he's a good reader. He's widely read. So, you know, I care about what he has to say about it. But I'm not sending it to my mother because, you know, she's going to love it no matter what.
Or conversely, you're sending it to people who just like giving opinions.
Yeah.
You can send it to me, and I read a lot. But what do I really know? I want to feel like I'm giving you value, so I'll give you criticism. This happens in the corporate world all the time. You send it to people through committee. People just want to have their voices heard. Mm-hmm. They give comments. They don't know how much work went in to make that happen. They don't know really the vision that you're driving towards. And everybody just, you know, puts in their two cents. But you do have to make yourself happy. And it's great that you have a few people that you trust to give you constructive, truly constructive feedback. That's the important thing.
When you think about what goes on an album, it sounds like, first of all, it sounds like you're very prolific. So generally, one likes to fit just so many songs on an album before you And you can talk about quality, and you can talk about these 10 or 12, you know, I think these are good because they've hit the quality level I like to get. But there's more to it than that. And so kind of what goes into that decision process to say, you belong on this album, and sorry, you're really good, but you do not?
It's mostly a conversation with Calvin, my producer. So because I've been playing for so many years and not recording, I have a big back catalog of songs. And as I said, many of them, like, I don't think are good enough to even send to Calvin because they're a bit repetitive. But there's a lot of them that are. And so I'll take some of those, and I'll take the songs that I've written throughout the year, and I'll put together a few dozen songs, and I'll send them to him, and we'll have a conversation. And I'll order them. Like, here are my top 10 that I would put in the mix, and then these are all the other ones. And he'll look at them, and he'll give me his opinion. Now I make the final call, but I give him a lot of deference because he knows what he's talking about. He's a guy who's worked with some of the top, Canada's top, not just indie artists, but Canada's top talent. He's phenomenal, and also I just trust him. So it is a conversation now. How do we pick those songs? We pick what we think are the best songs and the ones that make the best mix. Now, we've only done it so many times, so far the best songs have been in the best mix. Just in this last one, we've had songs we thought, ooh, you know, not for this one, but I think we should keep it for the next one. And that's like a good thing, too, to have. I'm still writing more songs. But maybe the one that wasn't good enough for that album that we thought for the next one, maybe doesn't make it to the next one either because we're writing more. Basically, I write so many songs that it passes through me to think, are these good enough that I want to go through the whole process of putting them in the studio? Then I need a second opinion, and he gives me that. So it's about the best songs, the best collection of songs. Once we get in the studio, really any song can be great. You get some good professional musicians on a song that's not that great, and it can sound great. I'm glad, Kevin, you mentioned earlier that you resonated with the stories. I assume that was the lyrics as much as anything else.
Yeah.
I'd like to think that I do a good job of that. I like to think that I'm telling interesting stories, and I want that to keep that continuing, and I want to be conscious of that. But there is also this great safety net that I know that if I fail at that, there's always these musicians. I don't want it to get there. I want to continue picking the best songs, but that's it's nice to know. So the short answer is we try to pick the best songs. Longer answer is a combination of best and combination. It can't just be nothing but happy songs. It can't just be nothing but sad songs. It's got to be a variety.
Right.
And everyone needs an editor.
Yes.
Basically.
Do you ever try out songs in front of an audience just to kind of get a little bit of feedback of something?
I do, actually. So I go to open mic nights. I still do. And in a performance, I'll play songs. I'll play the songs that I've recorded and released. I'll play the songs that I've recorded that I haven't yet released. But I'll throw in one or two songs that I've recorded and that I like and just, like, see how it goes. Now, the audiences are always kind. They always clap. But every now and again, someone comes up to me and says, I really like that song.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good feedback.
Yeah. Mm. Or it's very energetic clapping.
Yeah, or something like that. But it's also good feedback because when I, like this last album, the one that we're recording now, on three songs I put a note, received good audience feedback. Mm-hmm. And two of those songs ended up coming on the album. So it did. The other one might one day, but it makes a difference. When you have a few dozen songs, you got to pick them. The ones that I enjoy playing, that matters too. But the ones that people enjoy hearing matters as well.
I think it's important too for creative people to understand that when someone takes time out of whatever to give you a comment because it touched them in some way, that one person is representing, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 other people who didn't take the time to do it, but they still kind of felt the same way.
Feedback is a gift. It is always a gift. Even when it's negative feedback, it's something that you can take. It means that you're doing something and people are responding to it. And this person who's telling you that is letting you know about it. Now, some people also just like giving their opinions and they're you have to trust the source of the feedback. But I agree with that. I also try to put an emphasis on songs that I enjoy playing. And I try to bring that energy to my demos because not every song on my album, you know, when I do a show, it's not me with a band. It's me just playing on the acoustic version of these songs. And that's a big difference. That's part of me being confident enough to go in front of an audience and play these acoustic versions and saying there's a studio sound. Some of these songs that are great studio, I wrote in either the guitar or the piano or whatever, don't translate very well to a live performance. I haven't yet cracked how to make them sound good on stage, so I don't play them. I got to make sure that every time I have some kind of a project, I've got a song or a couple of songs on that I can actually play live for people to get excited about the new stuff.
Right. Interesting. Hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. There's of course, the whole last few albums of the Beatles' career, they never played live. I think mainly because of their complexity. Not that they were unplayable songs. They just didn't do it because they weren't touring either. Yeah. And it took a tribute band to go out and actually play those songs using modern technology and all this other stuff to get the sound right. But I often wondered what the more produced songs like on Revolver would have sounded like if they actually took them out live. But
well, for certain songs, like for Tomorrow Never Knows, you'd have to take the track of them playing everything that was spat out backwards and actually just put that digitally into the recording.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to play guitar backwards.
but the Beatles is a great example of, like, even if they played for 3 hours, they could literally just play songs that are easy to play as a band.
Right.
Because they have, every single song they have is a phenomenal. Like, it doesn't matter. Like, play all of them, you know? But they could play just the ones. They could go back and, you know, had they done this, just the four of them with instruments that were basic, like they did in the 60s, and still have a full-on show. You wouldn't need the prep, but you could also add the production and do, like, the Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds and all that stuff, too. What was great about the White Album and Let It Be, I mean, among other things, and Abbey Road, is that they did get back to, after Sgt. Pepper and Magical Mystery Tour and Revolver, they did actually get back to doing songs that you could replicate live. So they kind of, you know, peaked with Sgt. Pepper and Magical Mystery and then came back down to the ground with almost like a different sound than what they started with at the early part of their career. So they
had tons. Did you see that Peter Jackson documentary on the Let It Be?
I did. I loved it. It was like hanging out with friends. And it inspired a song that I wrote. John Lennon turned to George Harrison at one time and he was like, simply because blah, blah, blah. Simply because blah, blah, blah. And I thought, ooh, that's a good title for a song. So I wrote a song called Simply Because, turned it into a story, and it's going to be on my next album.
Nice. I just found it fascinating how they had... We're returning to those live playing roots because they said, you know what, we were a damn good live band. Why aren't we doing that? And they play it on a roof. Anyway, spoiler alert.
What was amazing about the roof concert with the full thing is I didn't realize how many times they played the same song. They played like the same song like four times.
Yes.
They were doing it to try to get
they were recording it, yeah.
And so I was like, this is take one, take two. I hadn't realized that before. Where I didn't pay attention to it. But yeah.
Oh, yeah. That kind of thing surprised me too. I worked in a situation where, you know, those New Year's Eve, you know, rockin' New Year's Eve kind of shows are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I sat in on the recording of one of those 2 days before New Year's Eve, and <Yeah. laughs> I realized, oh my God, the whole thing is just fake. this party,
it's like show business is fake. Ooh,
yeah, that's... I mean, I knew it was fake, but I didn't know like how fake, right? But there's this ballroom full of people who were basically hired to come in and look pretty and have a party.
Oh man!
And then the band would play some stuff, and it was studio augmented, and it was just, I mean, like, oh my God. I can never watch one of these things again.
I think you already answered the what project are you working on now question. So what is next for Danny Horowitz?
Well, I am going to be going into the studio next week to record with those students. Because I have such a pipeline of songs, I don't know when those songs are going to be released. If they get released, if it's anything good, but that's fun. I'm releasing songs right now. Sorry from the Road just came out. It's No Use Trying to Change. It's going to be out June 2nd. And I've got a show that I'm playing on Canada Day, July 1st. I'm also going to try to play some music in other places, do some other shows. I'd love to come down to the States and play some shows. Because I'm not an American citizen, I can't get paid for any of it. But just to have the experience of going down there and playing seems like it would be a lot of fun. Just fun times.
Yeah.
All right.
The Canada Day show, I think, is probably the next live show and the last one I have on the books right now.
I think it's time for our resources section.
Resources. I've got one.
Okay. You go ahead. And then I'll tell you how much I cheated.
Yeah. I figured something like that was coming. So my resource is actually to create yourself a resource.
Oh.
By that, I mean start a creativity journal. I keep multiple journals. I keep one for poetry and nonfiction ideas, thoughts in general, and a reading journal and a story journal and a work diary of all the things that I did today. And the diary helps me track what I've actually done because the memory can trick you into thinking you didn't do anything. You know, you look back a week later and it's like, I did nothing last week. But the diary would prove otherwise. The others are just really a great place to store ideas for those moments when you're not really sure what to do next, or you're just kind of stuck and maybe you want to do something different. And also, it's a place where I store my thoughts on process or start to make plans for something I want to do in the future. And I don't necessarily do it all every day. It's just whenever I'm thinking about that particular creative project. I've got a couple of links on how to kind of get started with creativity journals, and I'll put those in the show notes.
Nice. Yeah. I keep two journals. Mm-hmm. One is the thoughts and kind of commonplace book stuff that I do, and the other one is the rather beat up work in progress journal, which has like snippets of staff paper pasted into it. And
yeah, I mean,
what are we going to do next time? Kind of notes.
My journals are really just electronic notes in my note taking mm-hmm. app. Some people write, they want to write in a physical journal, and
that's me.
That's good too. It doesn't matter what the medium is; it's the practice.
Yes, 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 indeed. All right. So I brought this is. It's all I'm cheating. So in our February episode, we talked with Dewey Hargreaves. He brought up Embrace Your Weird by Felicia Day. So I took up the challenge and I read it cover to cover. And it's great.
All right.
Yeah, that's it. No, just kidding. No, I did. I did read it. And the thing what I enjoyed about it, now, first of all, almost every book on creativity has the same stuff in it, right? And it's all seems to come down to presentation, Julia Cameron has the her 12-step program to unlocking your creativity. Stephen Pressfield beats you over the head and so tells you to rub some dirt on it, get back in there.
Go to war.
Go to war with your art. Rick Rubin kind of is the Zen master of creative practice. And Felicia Day is refreshingly irreverent, funny, and serious without being serious in her presentation, like she is with most of her stuff, Instagram or pretty much any creative outlet that she has. She's always fun and irreverent and weird, and emphasis on weird and nerdy. And her book comes across the same way. So what I enjoyed about it is it presents a lot of the same types of things and a lot of the same types of thoughts, but it does it in a way that is very Felicia Day and also very encouraging. It's all positive, 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 positive. It's mm-hmm. really kind of, it's a fun read. And so, I mean, if you are trying to get back into a creative practice, especially if you're trying to get back into a creative practice and you want a fun approach to do it, I really can't recommend anything better than this, quite honestly, as a way to sort of get going again. Definitely fun stuff. So that's mine.
Sounds good.
Felicia Day's Embrace Your Weird. And thank you, Dewey Hargreaves, for putting that out there for us. Okay. Danny Horowitz, thank you so much for joining us. This has been super fun. Tell us where folks can find you and find your music and all the stuff about you.
Yeah, this has been great fun. John, Kevin, thanks so much for having me. They can find me anywhere you get your music. First of all, my name is Danny Horowitz, one N in Danny, V in Horowitz. So type my name in, wherever you get your music, or just Google, and please, please, please listen to me. I'm on Instagram at Danny Horowitz, just my name, but squished together with no space between the first and last name. I'm on Facebook at Danny Horowitz Music. Instagram is where I'm most active. I did have a TikTok account, and then they banned me from having a TikTok profile because I was sending and receiving messages to people who followed me, asking them to, directing them to my, to listen to my music, because I don't really care about making videos. I'm not doing this for the likes. I'm doing it for the listens. And because I suppose I wasn't really uploading videos and I was just messaging people, TikTok eventually was like, you need to stop this. And I didn't. And then they said, okay, you're out. You're cut. So I don't have TikTok. Maybe one day under a pseudonym I'll do it again. But Instagram, great place to connect with me on social media. If you find me on Instagram, shoot me a message if you've heard it. I'd love to hear from people. Add my songs to your playlists, and that's it. DanyHorovitz. Please listen. Please support indie music. Means a lot.
And thanks again. It's been great.
And I'm John Davis, musician, composer. You'll find me on all the socials as JD Sampo. And also you can find me under John M. Davis on various YouTubes and Bandcamps and Spotify's and Amazon's and even Substack now, because I'm one of the cool kids.
And I'm Kevin J. Fellows, novelist and poet. You can find me and my books and all the ways you can connect with me at my website, kevinjfellows.com.
Awesome. Danny, once again, thank you so much. This has been tremendous fun. We really appreciate you taking the time, and look forward to talking again sometime.
Yeah.
Me too. I'm glad. Our time is up. Is that it? Our time is up?
Yeah.
Well, the time was right. Let me tell you that.
Yeah.
And
no pun intended.
No pun intended, but also a little intended. So thank you for having me back.
We'll just call it a callback.
Yeah, exactly. Call back. I think I said something like that. Yep. So, good night,
cool.
Guys. It was great.
Appreciate it. Great. Thanks a lot. Yeah,
really fun.
All right. Bye.
Speaking of failure, by the way, sidebar, I figured out where the echo was coming from. It was actually coming from me because the speakers were still up on my mixer.
Oh.
And I was actually getting feedback from the speaker that's like right here. And
if the failure at that point is coming from you, then I say we keep in the discussion about it and then we can loop back to this part.
Right.
it's amusing now instead of being my fault. It's your fault.
That's
right. It's what Groucho Marx said about the difference between tragedy and comedy. Tragedy is when I get a paper cut. Comedy is when you fall down a flight of stairs.
Right.